First of all, with regard to assigning blame, I have to acknowledge that I was not the one who blew up the Trade Center, and I did not have anything to do personally with the virgin birth of Jesus, or with the founding of the modern state of Israel. So I can't take credit or blame for any of those things. And Ross mentioned that I go to the mosque and I get to talk with the people. Probably the most important thing I get to do is listen to them for an awfully long time before I talk to them. And then after that, I am able to talk with them on some things. And so I'll tell a little bit about our work and what I found some of the Muslims think and believe, and some literature that I developed, which I have over on the piano. Unfortunately, I don't have copies of everything but with me today, but that I found useful in reaching them. I might just express a little bit of the background of how I got into this local work with Muslims. Our radio programs broadcast to the Middle East and in the Middle East until last year, but now they're broadcast to it on shortwave. We're English Bible studies, and then later we added Arabic Bible studies. And I had studied previously items of Jewish, Messianic Jewish type of apologetics and reaching Jewish people and so on. And so that, I felt, helped with the radio programs to to discuss things that were of interest to them. But then as we were reaching more and more Muslims, I felt it would be really good to know what Muslims believe more about it than just what you read in a book or two. So I read some more books, went to some seminars, and then in about 1980 or 93 or 94, we had an opportunity, my wife and I, to meet Dr. Anis Zaka, who's from Egypt originally and now in Philadelphia. And he founded something called the Bridge Team Approach, or it's under a church organization actually called the Church Without Walls, which makes people stop and think when you hear that, the Church Without Walls. But what it is actually is a church on paper, in essence. It actually exists. But the purpose of it is to get people from many different denominations in the local church and have them find a mosque near them that they can sort of meet and be friends with the people and have meetings back and forth. And Dr. Zaka calls these meetings for better understanding. And the idea is that you go to one place or the other and vice versa, and you explain why you believe what you believe, not what's wrong with the other guy's belief, which we can usually figure out pretty quickly what's wrong with somebody else's belief, but why it is that we believe what we believe, and then different facets of our life and our understanding in that way. And so that's how it sort of started. And I live and attend a church in Village Church in Burbank, California. And so in starting this, we got acquainted with different people there and from some other churches in the area, a couple of other churches. And so we met together. We studied the Quran, and we studied more points in the Bible that were appropriate to dialoguing with Muslims. And then we prayed about what mosque we should approach. And I actually drove by about four or five different places in the San Fernando Valley. And the one that seemed like God laid on our heart was one that was about 2 miles from the church. And it's a Sunni mosque. Most of the people there are from Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and Middle East, but sort of in those predominant order. And so we approached them, and it was very interesting in getting acquainted with them. And we had four meetings, two at the mosque and two at the church, until the final D-Day, which I'll explain, and what happened then. And since then, our work with them changed, but God had his hand in all of this. I'll just tell how, now that maybe you're curious, what happened on D-Day. The things were going so well. We had these meetings at the mosque and the church, and one of them we had especially was to discuss about God, why we trust God and how we trust him for things. So the point was that We as Christians were explaining why we trust God. Well, he's omnipotent. He's got all the omnis there and so on. And then he knows the future, of course. He knows the past. He knows everything perfectly here on earth and what will happen, you know, and ahead and different things. And then how do we trust him? We remind ourselves to trust him. We pray to him and so on. We study his word so that we know how he wants us to live on these things and so on. Then what kinds of things do we trust him for? We trust him for our health, for our wealth, for our spouse, for our job, for our, you know, the future, and ultimately for our future destination. We trust God for this. So we went through different things like that, and the Muslims didn't have it nearly as organized as we did, but they had some presentation on it. And then the final D-Day was a meeting at our church, and they had found out that my wife and I also teach biblical archaeology and things like that and have worked in the Middle East or studied there. So they wanted us to really just take the whole evening and present things on the Middle East, the history and geography and archaeology of the Middle East. Of course, that's the Bible, and we're talking about the Bible areas. So we had our little group of us that had worked together, and one of our men brought another friend of his from church and who had not been to any of our groups, had not studied anything particular about Islam. And he came and he brought his big Bible under his arm. He could you'd think he'd wrench his arm or something carrying it. And he looked rather scruffy. And he came there and I introduced him to three of the Muslim men that we were really praying for and working on, you know, helping them to understand the Bible and God as he describes himself in the Bible and all these things. And this young fellow, all he did, he shook hands with each of them and then he said, "Well, I have a question to ask you." And they said, "What's the question?" He says, "Well, you don't believe that Jesus is God, do you?" They said, "No, we don't believe that." He says, "Well, you're going to hell." And so with that, he was giving the gospel, you see, in Burbank. And then after that, for some reason, the Muslims didn't want to meet with us anymore on these type of things. But before that, they had actually, in this going back and forth, they had actually thought that they would have a family. They were used to having what we used to, in our church years ago, used to call family fellowship. Once a month, we'd get together and, you know, do the good Christian-American way, eat. And so we'd have a potluck dinner, and we'd just have family fellowship and sometime a little, you know, program afterwards. But it's mostly to get the families together. Well, the mosque had something basically like that going virtually every month. And so they were thinking, people at the mosque, of having that at the mosque one month, at our church the next month, and then switch, you know, and that. But after that, it fell apart sort of in that way. But God had his hand in it, because that led me to not wanting to lose our friendships that we'd made. And so I started attending the mosque on Friday at the 1 o'clock or 1:15 when they have the, I call it the men's prayer meeting. I guess that's a good name. Men's, most people, we don't usually describe it that way, but the men's prayer meeting on Friday on Juma, and listening to their sermon, because among other things, with my legal background and some in police science, I was interested in thinking, now, what is it that they are teaching their own people? In other words, if you lived here in this city and you were a Buddhist and you wanted to know what Christians think, you could either buy a bunch of books on Christianity or, you know, there are some here I'm sure you have. Or you could come into the church and listen to the sermons, and not being a Christian, but you could come in and listen to the sermons and know at least what the preachers here are teaching the people here at this location. Now, it's not necessarily the same as what every Christian preacher in the world is preaching to their congregants on that Sunday, but it has a certain strain of familiarity. And then as I did this, as I started, probably the first time or two I went on a Friday was one of the most encouraging things I ever had. And of course, sometimes people get encouraged because somebody else is discouraged, and that's the way this was. Because I went, and as I sat in the back on the floor, I noticed you all sit on chairs here. It's rather odd. I'm not in services too often where people sit on chairs, but anyhow, I'd sit in the back in this intersection, way in the back on the floor, and the imam that spoke that day got up, and he basically didn't encourage anything. He was saying that he was very sad and discouraged. He kept using those two phrases, "We are sad and discouraged as a Muslim ummah of the whole world, the Muslim believers in the world, because of what is happening. And this was like back in 1995, what was happening in Pakistan or in Afghanistan, because the communist Russians had been kicked out. But now, at that time, the different warlords were fighting against each other, Muslims fighting Muslims in Afghanistan. If you remember, the city of Kabul was, you know, almost wiped out or made very desolate because of Muslims fighting Muslims in Afghanistan. And then he said, in Palestine, we're very sad and discouraged because we feel that the people who were oppressed, meaning the Palestinians being oppressed by the Israelis, as he was expressing it, now that they were getting the Palestine Authority and so on, he said, we're afraid that those who were oppressed will become the oppressors, you see, of other Palestinians, of the Christian Palestinians and the others that, you know, might disagree with the Palestinian Authority. He went through about six places. I didn't want to sit there and take notes or anything, because that sort of squelches things sometimes if you would do that. So I wrote down at the time about four or five different places around the world where they were sad and discouraged about things that happened. And it was really an eye-opener to me to hear them express this. And I think in a long run, what happens with some of the things both in Islam and in Christianity is, if you read the books and hear some of the leaders, just as if we like listen to Billy Graham, well, you and some of the other famous evangelists, you sort of think, well, Christianity is sweeping the world and is gradually or rapidly conquering the world and getting many, many more adherents. But if you go to the average church, you hear about so-and-so who's sick, or somebody who's out of a job, or somebody who's, you know, the problems we face, and all of these types of things. And it's more of a sort of like pull together and that than in a way it should be. We should be more on outreach and pulling together and outreaching to other people. But that's sort of my impression also with the Muslims. A lot of it is what they're doing in the local mosques is just sort of hanging their people together and so on. We just finished Ramadan. I like to go on in the evening and eat with the men. And after they eat, it's not that the food is very good. If you like hot Pakistani food, it's very, very good. And sometimes it's goat, usually it's beef, more often it's chicken. But it's very hot, and that, which I enjoy. My mother was born in India of missionary parents, and so I got used to some hot food. But after they eat the meal, the time that God really blesses is when you eat the meal, and then they're vacuuming up the carpet and so on, and you sort of hang around and get to talking to two or three or four people. And that's been some of the most blessed times, because then I've been able to explain things more. And during Ramadan, and sitting on the floor, is, to me, I've likened it to, at the time, I'm 60 years old now, but when I was little in church, we used to have an altar up front, and at special times, people would come up to the altar to pray, to be saved, or pray for whatever, or different things. And when you're up at the altar, it seems like it's a special place. It's not just like sitting back in the pew in the church, but when you're up there, you expect sort of a spiritual encounter with God. And that's what I feel a lot of these men in the mosque have, and especially during Ramadan. They don't sit there and discuss the ball scores or the weather and things like that. The conversation, about 90 or 95% of it, is maybe a little bit, is about, you know, how have you been, how's your family and that, and so on, health-wise and so on. But otherwise, it's on spiritual types of things related to God or, you know, Islam and so on, different things like that. But one time I was there, and the Rashid, the head of the local mosque, he asked me, he said, oh, he said, Dr. DePue, he said, have you ever read in the Quran about paradise? And I said, well, yes, I have. And he says, well, let me read it to you. Like he didn't hear me, I said, yes, I've read. But anyhow, I figured, well, God knows what's happening. So he went and he picked up the Quran. I have to remember to take this back home so Dr. Ross doesn't find it next Sunday. I'll stroke it. anyhow, he went over and he read about paradise. And he read about the the water, the fountains, and the food, and so on. And he was coming to a part where I think he was going to be discussing about the maidens and so on. And anyhow, he came up and said, and then it gives further details. I said, okay. And then I said, well, have you, there were six of us there involved at that time. I said, well, have you ever read in the Bible about paradise? And frankly, I know most Christians haven't, because you don't call it paradise, you know. But after all, Jesus said to the thief on the cross, what did he say? Today you'll be with me in paradise, okay? So I guess paradise is okay for those of us in California to use as a term. So I said, well, did you ever read about paradise? The Bible. They said, no. I said, well, I have out in my car. Let me go get my Bible. And it's the only time I've taken my Bible into the mosque itself. Except, well, maybe I did when we had our MBUs, our meetings for better understanding. But the only time I went to one of their meetings, like, and so I went out to the car, and I had taken this big Hebrew, Greek, interlinear with the English, of course, on it. So I went there, and I said, now, do any of you speak Greek? And they all acknowledged they did not speak Greek. They're more literate than I am in other languages, but none of them spoke Greek. So I said, well, I won't read it to you from the Greek, then I'll just read you the English. Because, of course, they read the Quran in Arabic and recite it and different things. So they very much respect the original type of language. But I said, the last two chapters in the Bible tell about paradise. I said, it also tells about the lake of fire, like hell, but it also tells about paradise. Let's read that. So I opened it up, and I changed the name, which we can discuss later here, about God and Allah. But I used the word Allah there, where it says, and Allah will dwell with his people. And there won't be any need of a sun or moon, because Allah will be the light, and the Lamb, I said, that's a technical name for the Messiah, for Jesus the Messiah. The Lamb will be like the lantern type of thing. And there will be the water of life, and the tree of life. And the leaves of it are for the healing of the nations. And the word nations there in Greek is ethne. It's the ethnic groups. So look at all the ethnic groups fighting. And the Soviet Union is broken down, and now the ethnic groups in it are fighting each other and so on and all this. And so it really impressed them. Their eyes were so big. They said, that's in the Bible? I said, yeah, the last two chapters. But they could see, and that there would be no more crying, no more tears. No more disease and so on. Well, this strikes everybody, you see. And this is the thing that I think I try to use to get them curious, to study the Bible, to think about, not just to argue over whether Jesus is God and all that at first. You've got to open their heart to a lot of other things before you get to that. In just a rapid points here, let's take some of these things here. One point that you can remember very easily, I have some literature on it, but you can remember the key point of this very easily, is they are taught in the Quran, which of course is their holy book, as you understand, and I don't go into details of how they got it, but it says in there definitely that there's a section talking about the Jewish people, the leaders of the Jews. And then as it goes on and it says all these bad things they did, it comes down to the point where it says they did not crucify Jesus. They were they thought they crucified him, but definitely they did not, and so on. So the Muslims understand that Jesus did not die on the cross. Now some of them say nothing like that ever happened. It was just a dream or a vision that God put into the heads of many people, and they just thought they crucified him. Others say that yes, there was a man who was put on the cross, but that man was probably perhaps Judas or someone else who was given a thank you, Shukran. Who was given a the Shukran is the Arabic part. I forget. I'm sorry. In California, we say gracias, but to that word is interesting. Mayim in Hebrew is the word for water, and it's the same word you use now in Jerusalem when you want water. In a restaurant in Jerusalem, in a Hebrew restaurant, it's the same word in Genesis chapter 1, mayim, for water, and may in Arabic, right? Now, regarding this on the cross, now, if they were deceived, And the way that they understand it, the Jewish leaders were deceived. And I also, beside going to the local mosque, my wife and I have attended many times down at the Islamic Center of Southern California on Vermont Avenue. They're about 3rd Street in Vermont. And every time there's something big in the Islamic community, you usually see Dr. Maher Hathout or his brother, the other Hathout, on there explaining the beauties of Islam and so on, and how they were not responsible, of course, and they're not personally or anything, for blowing up different things and so on. But I've been there on Sunday morning, and actually it's just finishing now, at 10 o'clock from 10 till 11:30. They normally have, like, basically it's a question and answer time. And that's when my wife and I went there. We started listening to the questions and the answers that were given. And we did this maybe once a month for several months, and I started to then catch the teacher afterwards and explain to him, well, from the scripture, where he was wrong on some things and some points where he was right. And I tell him, well, you would have been a stronger, there are some things right in their religion, and you could tell from the Bible something. You would have had an additional, ammunition on your side if you were studying the Bible and you realized, well, that had come up and had been discussed by Jesus or by Moses or different things. But in hearing that, I heard several times they said that Jesus did not die on the cross, very definitely, so on and so forth. So I prayed about this a lot, and God has given the answers to some of these things. And so what I did was I went through the Gospel of Matthew, and I took the different points, and I called it proof that Jesus did die on the cross. It's a matter of the chain of custody. And if you study police science, you realize that you have to have a chain of custody of your evidence. And I got to thinking, well, Jesus, all the way from the time of the Last Supper till actually the burial in the tomb, he was either with his friends who knew him, or he was in the custody of people who hated him and who wanted to destroy him, but they were very definitely, they knew whose body this was. So I went through that, and I wrote up a paper like this. I sent it to my friend who is the teacher there now, now my friend, and I sent it to him. And then when I was down there the next time and he was asking me questions, I said, what about that? Did you get that one? Oh, yes. He said, David was very kind. He went through the Bible, made it sound like, Matthew's the whole Bible. But went through the Bible, and he proved very definitely that there were eyewitnesses and that Jesus did die, that the Bible does definitely prove that Jesus died on the cross, and that I had followed it all the way from the Last Supper, which I didn't use that name in it, but he used it, all the way to the resurrection and to the wounds that were on Jesus' body and so on. And then he threw it open. He says, do you have anything you want to add? And it's a crowd about like this or even a little bit larger. He said, do you have anything you want to add? And I said, well, that I was raised in the church and I heard my father preach the sermons on the crucifixion. And I never realized that those wounds that he had were, like a certain soldier, like Rufus hit him here and made a wound on him. Well, then later when he's on the cross, Rufus could look at the man on the cross and say, yeah, there's the one that's the mark that I put on his body. See, here in America, most preachers are trying to prove, yeah, that Jesus was raised from the dead, right? I mean, that's the Easter sermon, and Good Friday type of thing is on that emphasis. But I said, this was something I never thought about before, but that proves that Jesus was the one on the cross. And then something we don't think about much, which helps you a lot in dealing with Muslims, is that they believe, or they pay great attention to what angels do and what angels say and so on, because they believe actually that their holy book, the Quran, was transmitted to Muhammad by the angel Gabriel, or Jibril, they call him. And so they think about angels quite a bit. And most of us remember when, after the resurrection, there were two women, at least, who came to the tomb. And what did the angel say to them? Anybody remember? It's been a while since Easter. He's not here, okay? Anything else that he told them, just from memory?
Why are you looking for the living among the dead?
Okay, why are you looking for the living among the dead? Anything else?
Don't be afraid.
What?
Do not be frightened.
Do not be frightened. That's a good one, because so often the Muslims recognize that when they feel that when an angel appears to someone, that they'll be frightened, and they are frightened, and the Bible shows that. But the angel, the Christian angel, the godly angel, always says right away, don't be afraid, you see. But they Muhammad was extremely afraid and went through a lot of things when he was getting his message. And so that's what makes a lot of people think that it could be, you know, that it's not. We know it's not from God the way it's what it is. But, what?
In other words, it was taken, right?
Yeah, probably, or some demon or something like that, that, you know, that it wasn't the, it's not the same message as in the Bible, so. I think it was probably a demon, probably, a demonic, you know, thing like that. But, anyhow. What? Well, he can only, Satan is not omnipotent. He can't be in all the places at one time. And so I know it's not, the message that's given in the Quran is not from God. maybe from World News at 7 o'clock or 6 o'clock, you know, sometime that, yes. That's what they they understand that the angel Gabriel got this. There are different views of it. Some of them think that the Quran existed eternally in heaven, which then some of our people will say, well, if you think the what they would call the Word of God, their Quran, existed eternally, well, the only thing that we know of that can exist eternally is God. So then some of our missionaries say, well, you're making the Quran like a second God, you know, and so on like that. But the usual thing is that God gave the words to Gabriel, and then Gabriel gave those to Muhammad, and then Muhammad, basically, they say, remembered them and recited them to men who wrote them down. But there are a lot of things that go along with that that's interesting. But
wasn't Muhammad illiterate, and therefore he had to dictate it and not?
More or less, it's kind of in a dispute because he apparently wrote his will at the end of his life, and he also worked for. They say, yeah, he was a slow learner. The one thing that bothers me about it, and that I brought up to them, is in Surah 96, which I believe is the first one given, the one where it says read or recite in the name of Allah, and so on. And further on, it talks about things that man that about. Like, know these things that God did not reveal, or that God revealed to man by the use of the pen of things that were written. And so I've asked them, I said, doesn't that indicate that Muhammad was to learn the Arabic language at least, or the language of Hebrew, where they had the Old Testament in, or the Greek New Testament? And they said, oh, no, it just means recite. But they acknowledge themselves it also means to read it, or to learn it. And my point was, he was supposed to be learning something that was had already been given, that God had given in writing, and they don't like to acknowledge that. I said, well, I feel if God told me, you are to learn Japanese because you're going to be a missionary to the Japanese, well, then I'd figure I better learn Japanese if I was really convinced in my heart that God wanted me to do that. Anyhow, just okay, one more, then I'll go back to this. Yes. Yeah, they did. Yeah, at the time, a lot of people challenged him on this because there were different people who he met or further on out in his sphere of influence who were Jews, Christians, and then the heathens, and a lot of them challenged him on it, and they got so much flack that he was kicked out or had to leave Mecca because his life was in danger. And so a lot of people challenged him on that, but it kept growing. There's a whole lot of history to it, but it was interesting. But excuse me, anyhow, back, we'll take some more questions in a little bit here. But back to a key point, the angel told shepherd, quote it here, I just referred to it, but the angel said to the women, he said, I know who you're seeking. You're seeking Jesus. Okay, so we know who it was. They were seeking Jesus. He was there at the tomb where Jesus was. He said, Jesus, who what? You probably never heard a preacher preach on this. Who was crucified, who died, and who has been raised? And where was this angel from? A friend here was asking about the angel. Well, it says an angel from the Lord. Where do angels come from? Angels come from heaven, from the Lord. So in our radio programs, when I was going through Matthew, I emphasized this. I said that this is very important. To listen, here was an angel who spoke from an angel who came from heaven, from God, and spoke and confirmed all this. Yes? No, this was just an angel talking about it. Yeah. What? It doesn't say in the Bible. Oh, yeah. Beats me. You can ask the Lord about that, or in eternity we can ask him. There's a whole bunch on God and who he is, and we'll probably get into that in explanations. Up here I have a copy of that on the crucifixion, proving that it was Jesus. Also, the other point that you can remember really simply, if you don't remember anything else from today, and you meet a Muslim, and they sort of want to talk a little, and you ask the Muslim, do you believe that Jesus died on the cross? They say no. And then you can tell them, a real easy thing, say, but we see that, who was there at the cross? Mary was there at the cross. And wouldn't it be a cruel thing, not just for a mother to see her son die on a cross, but wouldn't it be even more cruel for her to think her son was dying on a cross when he wasn't? Wouldn't that be even worse? And that seems to reach the hearts of Muslims. I found that there are things in talking with Muslims that are very simple. You can pray, and that's where God has helped me so much, is to pray for answers, not big, long, complicated answers, because most of them aren't. If you're dealing with somebody that is, then you can do it. But most of them will claim they're very ignorant, they don't know the Quran very much, and so on and so forth. So they do that. Anyhow, I also have a leaflet there called The Unique Oneness of God, and then another one called, based on the Paraclete, where they all ask you, they say, well, you know that that Jesus prophesied about Muhammad. And he said, no, I didn't read that in the Bible. I've been to church all my life. You know, I never read, the preacher never pointed that out to me. And they said, well, you know, where he said that he would send another one, another comforter, or another person to come along, you know, and that's Muhammad, naturally, you know. And then they have a sort of a tricky way of saying, well, that after Muhammad came, then the Christians changed the Greek text to mean what we call comforter or the paraclete, but originally they claimed the word was percluton, which when you translate that into Arabic means one who's praised, and one of Muhammad's names is Ahmed, like the praised one. So they use that, and I prepared a paper, since the fellow at the Islamic Center said, you know, blah, blah, blah about it, and so I went and I got the copy of the Codex Sinaiticus, which came out about 350 A.D., and was found at St. Catherine's Monastery by Mount Sinai. And so I had its microfilm sent to the public library, and I went down there and I had to look through it all to find it where it was, but I found the section in Greek, and I, you know, ran off Xerox copies of it, and I put it on the leaflet, sent it to the teacher, and after that he said that this definitely proves that Christians did not corrupt the Bible. John chapter 14, verse 16, which I was responding to one word in one verse in one chapter in one book, but he stood in the Islamic Center of Southern California and said, you should never say that the Christians corrupted the Bible, because they did not, because David was kind enough to prepare this and do this, and I don't think he understands all of it himself, but anyhow. And God gives us sometimes more credit than I was looking around for that guy you were describing this morning, who he was. But anyhow, and then I also have a bookmark that uses quotations from their favorite book about my favorite book. So I give it to them sometime. They say, what? Well, whose favorite? What? I said, it's from your favorite book. Things from your favorite book about my favorite book, about how they should study what was written before, what was given before, and different things. And the book, that's our Bible, is a light and a guidance to man, and different things like that. So I made it up as a little Quran mark. So if you have a Quran that doesn't have a Quran mark, I've got a few of those over here. And then we'll talk about the unique oneness of God, but we'll do that in this last half hour since I talk so much. Are there any questions? Yes.
Okay. I was reading in the Quran a while ago,
Yeah. Yeah, there are different opinions on it, but basically, yeah, that Jesus is no longer here on earth, and that he went back to heaven in some miracle, some way, and that he will be coming again, and he'll be coming as a judge. Not necessarily, some of them say that he'll be coming to rule, but others say that he will just be sort of a subsidiary, a judge, but that he will. There are a lot of different opinions. Some say he'll judge only the Christians, and that Moshe will come back and judge the Jews, and guess who Muhammad will judge? The Muslims, and I don't know who's going to judge all the other pagans and stuff and that. But anyhow, so you hear different opinions. Some have told me very authoritatively that Jesus is going to come back here on earth and will judge everybody in one day. That this will, or you know, he'll judge everybody in one day. Others said no, this will take 3 days. Others said 30 days. Others said 1 year, 3 years, and 100 years, and or 99 or 100 years, and 1,000 years. I said, well, you're probably getting more right when you talk about 1,000 years, from my understanding of eschatology, but not being a prophet nor the son of a prophet, I don't get into those. History, I know much better than the future. So, anyhow, but that's their view. Yeah, what they do is an interesting. One time, again, I was in the mosque, and the fella said, oh, let me read about Jesus. Have you ever read about Jesus in the Quran? I said, yes. He says, well, let me read it to you for me. So he was reading about it. And it says in the Quran, and if you understand it the way they do, is that the day that Jesus was born under a palm tree to Miriam or Mary, he spoke because people were talking evil of her having committed adultery. I mean, you know, they thought. And so that Jesus, the day he was born, actually as soon as he was born, he spoke up on behalf of his virgin mother and said that, you know, she's pure and so on. And he spoke of the day of his birth, the day of his death, the day of his rising again. And so right there it says the day of his death. So they know, those who studied it and really thought it through, a lot of them happened, know that sometime, either that Jesus was going to die, you see. But now some of them say that he's coming back to judge and then he will die and be raised again after that. But most of them don't think it through that much, and most of them don't even realize it, I think, when they read it in the Quran, because this fellow was standing in the mosque reading it to me, and his name, you probably can't remember his name. I'll tell you his name. I'll pronounce it in English. His name was Arafat, and he was from Palestine. But he had shaven. I said, what was that you read about the Jesus talking about the day of his death? He said, what? He didn't even realize what he read. He said, where? I said, well, you just read that, just, you know, like 10 seconds before. So he read it again. I said, he spoke of the day of his birth, the day of his death, the day of his rising again. I said, so Jesus himself talked about the day of his death. He said, well, I don't know. Well, let's go on and read some. So he went on reading some more. I found it's better to let them think a little. You know, they can't, throw over everything in 5 seconds or something. So he went on reading, and I was praying that God would work out something, you know. And here comes big, Muhammad from Bombay is coming across, you know, walking across there. He said, oh, Dr. Depew, how are you? And I'm, okay. And he brought out, I would say out of the blue, but God was working on his heart. He says, you know, you claim that Jesus died, don't you? I said, well, that's what it says in the Bible, you know. Don't blame me, you know, I didn't do it. I'm just pointing the wrong book, the Bible. That's what it says in the Bible, you see. And I found a way to do is sort of like you point to the book, you know. It's not, you didn't write the Bible. And it's, you're looking at the evidence that's in the Bible, and so you say, well, this is what I see here. You know, what do you make of it? You know, let's both of us look at this together here. Sort of like that attitude, that body language like that. So I said, well, yes, I did. And he says, well, you know, he never died. You know, and I said, well, Arafat here, put my arm around Arafat. You know, Arafat here just read to me from the Quran about Jesus talking himself from his own lips. Like, you know, dramatic. From his own lips about the day of his death. Oh, no, no. And I could see, when I'm looking up here at Muhammad, the big tall guy from India, tallest Indian. God took two Indians and stacked one on top of the other, make them that big. Over here, Arafat's shaking his head, no, I don't go into that subject about the day of about Jesus talking about his death. Muhammad's very sure, oh, no, no, blah, 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 blah. So I said, well, here, you just read that from here, didn't you? And they're each saying, oh, blah, blah, blah. And so I gently walked away. I didn't want to make them embarrassed, but that's, you know, the thing what happens. Any more? Yes.
I think the one question I want to ask, none other get answered, is, in your opinion, is Islam a religion of peace, as most people in this country claim?
Yeah, he asked, is Islam a religion of peace? It was not started as a religion of peace, and there's an awful lot in it that lends to not having peace. There's two different things I think we have to look at. In a way, rather than say Islam a religion, it's almost like Christianity a religion. Is Christianity a religion of peace? Well, those of us that are here in this room, probably all of us, have practiced a peaceful form of Christianity. But there are people and it tears my heart out to see in Northern Ireland where people who are calling themselves Protestant, calling themselves Christian, are behaving in a very un-Christ-like way, you see. And what I've found, I think that first of all, the name, the word Islam does not mean peace, it means submission. And the understanding is submission to God, and then submission to the rule of God's people, what they would think, all his people, God's people, in the society. And so that their understanding is that if you have peace, in order to have peace, you submit to God and to the God-appointed rulers, or the Muslim rulers in your society, and that, and to oppress those who do not agree with that, or who are not Muslims, to oppress them until they feel humiliated, and so that's sort of what it is. These are hadiths as recorded by al-Bukhari, one of the fellows who came along after the time of Muhammad, and he put together a lot of the things I was going to see. There's a lot of interesting things here. You ask about, is it a religion of peace? From this one, it says Allah's messenger, the hadiths are the sayings of Muhammad, and sometimes sayings and things that he did so people could get their guidance from that, you know, and then of some of the other people who were with Muhammad, who were well steeped in his traditions and understandings, some things that they said and did. But basically, it's the teachings that Muhammad gave to people orally that are not claimed to be directly from God, but since he was a prophet and so on, then that they like to follow that. And one of the interesting things is people will dress, one of the things you'll see them dressing with the robe on, you know, the men and women and so on, but the men especially will dress with the robe. And not all the time, but some of them do. And so some of them, I point, he says, you know, I got a nice fine robe. I say, that's very nice. I said, you know, Jesus wore a robe like that. Because I thought that would make him, you know, tear it off and say, oh, I don't want it. But he says, oh, all the prophets, you know. So, you know. Yeah, but I heard in the Islamic Center, somebody asked about that and said, well, what about wearing those? Isn't that a better Muslim and to show our acceptance of Islam, shouldn't we wear that? And the teacher said, well, no, not over here, you don't have to or something, because he said, after all, people forget that the sinners and the people who fought against Muhammad in his day also wore robes, and so on like that. I'll just read this one, then I'll take the question there. He says, Allah's messenger said, you, that is the Muslims, will fight against the Jews till some of them will hide behind stones. The stones will say, oh, Abdullah, it's a slave of Muhammad, or servant of Muhammad, I mean of Allah. In other words, they will, you'll chase the Jews till they hide behind a stone. Then the stone will speak out and say to you, there's a Jew hiding behind me, so kill him. And in another quotation, the hour has not come until you fight against the Jews. So they weren't to at this moment, but yeah, it came on. I have different ones. Also, I was telling Ross that here I have the section that says there were a couple of men that when they were fighting in the battle on behalf of Muhammad and his side, that Muhammad let them wear silken shirts because they had a skin disease causing itching. So from that, Muslim fighters can understand that you can wear a silken shirt when you're in battle, if you have a skin disease at least, yes. The Seed of Abraham in Arabic, Nasal Ibrahim, these are Bible, radio Bible studies where basically I take just going through the portions of Scripture. And our English ones are on Monday through Friday, 15-minute broadcast, and our Arabic ones are Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 15-minute broadcast. These were broadcast, or still are, through the Voice of Hope. Well, what used to be called Voice of Hope. It's a High Adventure Ministry started by George Otis, who's the senior, not the junior one that's doing, but George Otis, who founded that and started the broadcasting in 1979. And what I do is in English, since I realize that people hear this with from many different backgrounds, and also the people who hear it probably don't understand English as fast as you folks do. It has to be a little more English as a second language type of speaking, more slowly and using simpler words and so on. And I just do a regular Bible study and try to point out what God is having us understand. And I had a special series of Christmas broadcasts, which I try to build up the Bible and make people to understand it. Some of our preachers here, and I heard some in the Middle East, that they sort of say, well, you know, if you think, you know, one of the favorite places for the devil is to go to church, well, the devil does cause a lot of problems in churches, but if you're trying to reach outsiders and get them to accept and understand things of the Bible and Christians and that, you don't win them by saying the devil's favorite place to go nowadays in the world is in the church, because that's where he can do the most harm or something. That doesn't do it. I try to sort of build up in a proper way, I think, the thing. Yes, another hand there. Yeah, they conquered so fast, and that's what basically it was, the way it was spread. It wasn't by people going for their ideals. And that I was in the mosque one time. I was rather surprised. I heard a couple of men talking about the battles that they, you know, the Muslims had in ancient times, and one of them was saying, well, you know, the Muslim army went right up to the wall or the outside or the outskirts of Vienna, Austria. And then they turned back. They didn't conquer it. And they were both lamenting the fact that the Muslim army didn't conquer Vienna. Well, why should, you know, why should Arab Muslims from North Africa and from Arabia be up in what is now, you know, Vienna, Austria? You know, what are they doing going up there fighting? And of course they spread across North Africa and all these other places. But I find what I did when I met the Muslims at the mosque and other times, I say, look, I will not blame you for all the bad things the Muslims have done the last 1400 years if you don't blame me for all the bad things that Christians and so-called Christians have done the last 2000 years. And that really helped a lot. It's what we accept, or if we agreed with that, you know, like those two guys saying, well, that they wish the Muslims had have taken Vienna, Austria. Well, then I would think, in a little way morally, if I talked to them, it wasn't where I was hearing it, and what it was, I wasn't able to talk with them. But I think then morally, I could sort of say, well, you know, then you're morally as responsible as they were for going to other areas to conquer. Yeah, this in here. They point to different things in the Quran. I heard people say that where it says in the Bible when people say peace, peace, and peace and safety, they say, well, the two towers were showing a peaceful thing, peaceful existence of people from like 80 different countries or whatever working there peacefully for economic growth and development, you know, around the world and stuff. And then the Pentagon was a symbol of safety of, you know, like the biggest police department in the world, sort of like. And both of those were struck that day and stuff. But I don't know. I know more history than I do prophecy. And now, yes. Yeah. I think what she was saying, you probably couldn't hear it all, that one of the magazines, Zion's Fire, I think I saw that article. I get their things sometimes. It's a Jewish, Messianic Jewish magazine, and it was talking about Islam and so on, and about the idea that, which is true, at the time of Muhammad in Mecca, which is in Saudi Arabia, there was a Kaaba, which is still there now. It's a stone platform, and then a wooden structure on top of it, sort of almost square, not exactly square, but almost looks square. Structure on top of it, on which various cloths are put over it—a black cloth or a white cloth, and so on—and idea was that at the time of Muhammad, apparently there were 360 idols that were either in or around it. Some texts, some Arab Muslim texts, indicate that apparently that perhaps in the daytime these were taken and set out around, and of course we end up with 360 degrees in a circle too, which came through from Babylonian times, I mean, that we use today. But there were 360 days in the year, and so they put, or at least supposedly they worshipped a different idol each day, or they had one special one to worship that day. And they were probably all put in the Quran, in the Kaaba, the black box, as large, it's a building, a little building, at night. Now, a lot of these idols were probably just ones that one person could carry, but others would be a larger one. One of the idols, apparently, that was worshipped was Hubal, H-U-B-A-L, which was the moon god. And that one, some people carry it over and think that that sort of became Allah or something, but that is definitely, it's a different god. And that when Muhammad went in about 630 and cleansed the Kaaba, he took the god Hubal, which was apparently a statue, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 feet or 10 feet long or whatever, tall. He had it put down as a doorstep, so for a step for them to walk into, walk on this god to get in there, to show the disrespect for this god. And then he took out all the others and said they were to worship one invisible god that was the creator. So what I do when I talk to people with the Muslims, I tell them, well, you know, I understand that God is the creator of life and of everything we see. He's the sustainer of life, and he's the future judge, just to put it in sort of a nutshell. And then I think we describe him differently, we understand him differently, but I think that that is, and I honestly believe that these Muslims who are understanding traditional type of Islam, that they are talking about the right God, but they got a lot of the wrong ideas of him and attributes, and they don't accept the word from the Bible, basically, most of that. So I try to get them to understand that and do that. But yes, here.
There have been a lot of competing definitions. I'm a little puzzled now. What is jihad?
In Arabic, yes, what is jihad? The word in Arabic means the struggle. And what they tell their own people in the mosque and in their writings of it, in the modern writings, is that, and even in ancient writing in there, that it is a struggle, and you can struggle against a lot of different things, obviously. Now, the one thing that they say is, one time they went out for a battle, a physical, you know, war, a battle, and the men came back and they were happy because they'd won this battle. And Muhammad told them, he says, now the great jihad starts, and that's the struggle within yourself against sin and so on like that. And so this is what basically they teach the people in the mosque nowadays, is that it is the struggle, the most serious ones they have to worry about is the struggle against sin and unrighteousness and, you know, wrong things in their life. But it does also mean struggle against enemies, you know, outside. So it can be.
Does that just mean that bin Laden is telling people to send their lives?
No, he's telling them for war. Yeah, oh yeah. Bin Laden is using it that way. I mean, if somebody comes running in here, with a gun and a Kalashnikov and they're saying, jihad, jihad, well, I'd suggest we all duck and pray fast or in that order probably because it means that. You know, if somebody comes, you know, if the preacher comes and preaches this morning or next Sunday and says that you have to struggle and fight against sin in your life and you have to root out sin and pray to God to root out every remnant of sin and to live holy and pure lives before God, well, that's a struggle. And if you were to use it in Arabic, it would be a jihad.
Just what the Islamic Center would be preaching.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what they honestly believe in their heart. I mean, these things. I mean, I think that people will not be telling a group of people. I mean, on occasion, they will lie to somebody. But like I said with the illustration, that if you go in the church here and you hear the sermons that are taught here, it is at least, honestly, I believe, what the preacher believes is true and correct, as he understands it from the Bible, you see. I don't think he's getting up there saying, well, I'm going to really hoodwink these Christians and get them in here and you know, have them follow me and raise money, and then what we're really going to do is we're going to go and we're going to conquer, you know, Pomona, and we're going to take over the religious people in Pomona or something, you know. But most of them don't know it, you know. There's only 10 of them here that do that and stuff like that, so I don't. I guess it's in the back there, yeah.
I was thinking about Ross's question about Islam being peaceful. Your true Islamic religion is not peaceful. And it seems like the Muslims that are in America and in other countries have kind of gotten away from the true Islamic belief, because from what I've understood, that the demand that everybody else was infidel, and it's probably closer to what the Taliban.
I thought you were going to say the Calvinist. The Taliban, okay. I thought you were going to give us a comparison or something. I got a comparison between Christianity and
the Taliban had it closer, although it's very extreme, had it closer to grasp on what true Islam really is. But my question was, I don't know exactly how much you converse with the average Muslim, and I was wondering, and it kind of relates to my original question about their challenging. In the beginning, they probably challenged Muhammad, and then there were people who were ostracized.
Yeah.
But today, I'm wondering, what is the best way to approach another Muslim instead of debating them over Christian beliefs and the Islamic beliefs? Kind of ask them what they know about their own faith, because I think probably a lot of Muslims are just as clueless about their faith as a lot of Christians about.
Yeah. The thing is I try not to push them further into Islam. In other words, if I meet a Muslim who has just a mediocre idea of Islam and just shows up on Ramadan and a few Fridays and that's about it, well, I don't try to tell him what I think true Islam is and push him back into, you know, in other words, say you're not practicing the way you're supposed to in your belief, because that just pushes him further away from me and everything else and from belief in God. Well, the thing is, I don't even do that, because it's not all the same. You're saying pure or true Islam. Well, how do we know that we are practicing pure or true Christianity? Because there are a lot of people in the world who would come to us and say, well, you're not practicing true Christianity because here's historical things, and they had all these different sessions and congresses and stuff, and then now you don't honor the Pope, do you? I mean, how many people here follow and closely, you know, what the Pope says? Well, they would say, well, this is pure Christianity, you see. And there was St. Peter, then there was a whole line of popes after them, and there's a Pope in Rome now. And so you are not practicing true Christianity, because you're practicing a heretical group that came off in the 1500s or something, you see. So I find it's not very useful, and I don't, because I don't accept I don't accept from an outsider who's not a Christian how, in general, I wouldn't say, I wouldn't accept their evaluation of my Christian life and of where I am with God and of the way that I should practice to be a Christian. But I mean, if you go to them and you say their religion or their Islam is not, what they're practicing here is not true or pure Islam, you see.
I'm just saying, when someone challenges me and asks me a question, then it's position you to go and try and find an answer or to, you know.
Yeah, but you can look in the right places for the answer. They would look in the wrong places.
Yeah,
see, the thing is that they would look.
Try to find an answer.
What I've found, I'll just
explain. Because they don't have any background or any.
Well. But no, what they do is they go to the Islamic Center bookstore and they buy books on Islam and on the wars of Islam and all the glories that God gave them, victory over different heathens in these various places, and they get those and read them. And you have some black Americans doing that, especially, probably more than any other group of them as a percentage-wise of any other Americans that are doing that. But what I found is when they tell me any one of these things basically that comes up, I compare that with my understanding, my knowledge of the Bible and what God taught previously to the time of Muhammad. And I say, well, that is, some things agree with it. There are a few things that there are quite a few of you that agree. There are an awful lot that disagree with it. And I say, well, I'm concerned. What I use with them, because otherwise you get into sort of a fight and a verbal thing. I say, well, like, in other words, he says, well, you know, the Prophet Muhammad, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he was given the message and it says, so-and-so, you see. And then I say, but, you know, previous to that, more than 600 years before that, God was speaking to us through Jesus, or he was speaking to us before that through Moses and so on. There's a whole lot of interesting things about what you take and so on. But I say, but this is what I see, you know, in the Bible, it says this, you see. And then he says that. I said, so this is what I see here. And the Bible is supported by history. It's very historical. I've got to tell you this. Probably take questions afterwards, but after we quit. But it's very historical. You can follow it through a chronology. That's the way people think. We like to learn in stories. You can follow. You know, the man walked into the city. Something happened. He walked out of the city. This. The Quran is not that way. You can't follow chronological stories in it and so on. It's very. Geographical. You can look up, you know, you look on a modern map, you see names of cities, places. No, the Quran, you can't do that. It's very prophetic throughout the Old Testament, especially you see these prophecies of the coming of Jesus. You see Old Testament prophecies fulfilled during the time of Israel and Judah and so on, and the neighboring kingdoms. And then you see the prophecies of Jesus and the prophecies that Jesus gave. The prophecies in the Quran are very vague. Basically, it only really basically applies to the day of judgment is the main thing. And I say, well, that's no big thing. Even a lot of unbelievers in anything believe that this won't go on forever like that. And it's very, let's see, geographic, prophetic, and what was the other? Historical. And you can look at the name, you know, ancient peoples and tribes and that. Anyhow, I should close, and I'll be around here for a few minutes. And try to answer your questions. And when you do meet Muslims, God can give you answers, but it's good to study ahead of time. And remember that the Muslim you meet probably isn't responsible for blowing up the Trade Center, and he's scared. I went to the to both of the places where I go to that week. I went on Friday to the mosque, and then on Sunday I went to the Islamic Center, and they were all talking and condemning publicly and privately these things that were happening. And at that time it was not absolutely sure. They thought that things were coming out that it was probably these, you know, Arab Muslim guys, but it was not absolutely sure. But in their minds it was for all of them that these were Muslim fanatics and that were doing this stuff and blowing up other people and that, including other Muslims too. So anyhow, God bless you. It's glad to be here.
David, how long can you stay for more questions?
I've got a ride over here.
Okay.
20 minutes, maybe?
Okay. 15, he's given us 15 or 20 minutes more, kind of an off-the-cuff session, so let's be respectful of that time of his, but I want to say thank you very much. This has been great, and maybe we can do this again. Thanks, David. Let's pray. Thank you, Lord Jesus, that we have an opportunity to learn about other people. And by learning about other people, it makes us more humble and more certain of our faith. We ask you that we can use this information to bring you, God, to other people. And we ask for true humility in being able to do this. Thank you so much. Ask your blessing on this day, Lord. In your name, amen.